1:30 p.m. I'm speaking with Mr. Raymond Stuhl at his home located at 1515 University Drive. I'm speaking with Mr. Stuhl to gather information regarding his history for KU Oral History Retirees Project. I'd like to begin with a few questions about your childhood and proceed gathering as much information as time allows to the present. I'd like to first gain a little insight into your childhood. Can you tell me where you were born and the date, please?
I was born in November 3, 1906, in Kansas City, Missouri. My childhood consisted of a very normal childhood. Both of my parents were intensely interested in music. My mother was both a vocalist and a pianist, and took me to many, many concerts, both of symphony concerts, chamber music concerts, and solo concerts. I heard Yasha Heifetz when I was in seventh grade. This was the first time that Heifetz ever played in the United States. I heard the Minneapolis Symphony, I heard the St. Louis Symphony, and several other organizations, which, and the Cincinnati Symphony. These were symphonies that regularly came to Kansas City to play for rather a vast audience, especially if you take in consideration the per capita interest.
All right, can you tell me what your father did for a living, please?
My father had a school of watchmaking, engraving, and mechanical inventing of small machinery.
I see.
He was a successful teacher and had many students all over the 6 to 8 state area.
Is this where you spent most of your time as a child?
I spent most of my time as a child in Kansas City, Missouri. That's correct.
How many other members were there in your family?
There were two other members. One of my brother, who's living, is retired as the board of directors of the Couples Corporation in St. Louis. And the other one died at the age of 28, where he was an architect in the same office as Ed Tanner, who was the head of the Department of Architecture for the J.C. Nichols Company.
I see. Who probably influenced you the most in your childhood? In what ways?
That's a difficult question to answer off the top of my head. I would say my general family environment, and my parents, as well as one mathematics teacher whom I felt was the greatest teacher I ever had in my life.
Can you describe your family environment a little more?
Well, my parents were instrumental in forming the First Symphony Orchestra in Kansas City. They're the people who pushed a man who became Sir Carl Bush into the conductorship and the formation of the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra Society back in about 1910. He, together with Wallace Robinson, who was a big hotel operator and owned the Baltimore Hotel, as well as about 40 other hotels in this area. There were perhaps other people involved, but I do not know their names.
I see. I've read an article where you said that your father probably influenced you the most towards starting to play the cello. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
My father was always crazy about the cello. And he arranged for me to take cello lessons without my knowing it. He bought a cello. He had a friend who was quite a good cellist, German trained, and played in this orchestra as well as playing in a movie theater, which all musicians had to do, either that or teach. And so I went to the first lesson with a cello, hardly knowing what it was. But he was a very nice man, a very average teacher, quite a good cellist.
I see.
And I learned considerable from him. I would say I learned what was, in my opinion, easy to teach. That which was difficult to teach, he seemed unable to handle.
I see. What age were you when you actually began to play the cello?
About 10.
About 10.
Mm-hmm.
Did you play any other instruments as
no.
a cello? Just the cello?
No, just the cello.
I see. Can you tell me anything else about your childhood which stands out in your memory?
I thought of a couple of them that I didn't say it, and I forgot.
At the age of 15, after years of playing tennis, I won a tournament at the age of 15, which encompassed the entire city of Kansas City, Missouri, which was restricted to all people up to 18 years old.
So did your father also play tennis? Is that
no.
He didn't?
Neither my father nor my mother played tennis.
I see. So who told you to start playing tennis?
I just started playing tennis because my brothers played tennis.
I see.
My brothers played tennis rather bad.
So you enjoyed playing with them, I suppose.
But they wouldn't let me play with them at first because they played so much better than I did. And later, I wouldn't play with them for the same reason, only in reverse.
Were there any other activities or interests that you had when you were a child?
Well, I was interested in mathematics because of this very fine teacher I came in contact with rather early in life. He was a fabulous teacher. And if I have been successful in teaching, it's because I've learned so much how to teach from this one teacher who was far and above the finest teacher I ever had.
Is this a high school teacher?
This was a high school teacher, yes. And I also became... During my high school years, I was very interested in taking cars apart and even building cars. Much to the concern of my father, because mainly of the expense, and also because he thought I might get hurt, I assembled an automobile by buying a body and a frame, buying a motor separately, and completely taking the motor apart and replenishing it with new piston rings and valves, placing it in the car and making the car work. It wasn't a very handsome car, but it worked beautifully.
Did you work anywhere as a child, or did you for pay? Or?
I worked some with my father, but that was the limit.
I see.
Many young people had jobs in the afternoon, and I used to go down and work with my father, but not extensively.
I see. So what type of education did you receive? You went through high school?
I went through high school, practiced a great deal, went to junior college for a couple of years in Kansas City, and then went directly to Berlin.
I see. What high school did you attend in Kansas City?
Westport High School, which
Westport.
Was the only high school which serviced the entire southern area of Kansas City, including all of the Shawnee Mission area, etc., which was way out
really?
Of the country.
I see. So how many students were there in your class?
It was a large school.
Large school.
It was so large and so overcrowded that for 1 or 2 years while I was going to high school, all classes of the sophomore year were restricted to the morning. The junior year would be restricted to the afternoon.
Huh.
And the senior year would be restricted to whatever however they could handle it. But the growing population was a very big problem. And this was shortly before Southwest High School was built in order to alleviate the congestion at Westport.
I see. So then you went into junior college right after you graduated from high school?
That's correct.
What junior college did you attend?
The Kansas City Junior College, which at that time was located at 11th and Locust.
I see. And then you, so after junior college, you decided to go to Europe?
I went to Europe and studied with a private teacher for a year. All this time, of course, I've been practicing and playing.
Who?
After having studied cello for a year with a Hungarian cellist whose name is Paul Hermann, I entered the Hochschule with a famous cello teacher whose name was Hugo Becker, B-E-C-K-E-R. The Akademische Hochschule für Musik, which is the official name of the school I attended, was financed by the Kaiser and was the most luxurious school per student I've ever heard. We only had 110 students. You could not pay tuition. It was strictly a scholarship school. Everyone took his lessons in front of the other fellow. It was typically very international insofar as there were not more than two people in this cello class, of which I was a member, who were from the same country. There were two from Russia, one from Italy, one from Hungary, one from Sweden, one from Norway. I was an American, and there were two Germans, and that was it.
I see.
We were on test every day, and the moment our work was unsatisfactory, we were dismissed from the school. So that it wasn't a matter of grades, it was a matter of staying upright all the time. We always took our lessons in front of each other, which was very tough because those Russians had a fabulous education. There was no limit to the advantage of being accepted into this school. First of all, let me say that Bruno Walter was one of the two teachers of conducting. Bruno Walter was the conductor of the Metropolitan Opera, much of the time the New York Philharmonic, after he came here during Hitler's time, but before that he was the head of the City Opera in Berlin, which was an opera which operated 11 months in a year, strange as it may seem, every night to a sold-out house. George Zell was the other conductor, and he ended up in the United States as the permanent conductor of the Cleveland Symphony. I would say he was there for probably 30 years. A very famous man. Carl Fleisch was the violin teacher. He taught many of the famous violinists in the world today. And Becker came to this country for the first time playing joint concerts with Fritz Kreisler, who at that time was the greatest violinist in the world, by far. Also, Arthur Schnabel, who probably was one of the greatest influences in the applied musical world, was a member of the faculty. His class was very small. He never took over four or five students. And one year, 55 students tried out to get into Schnabel's class, and he didn't take any of them. It was a great, great privilege to be in his class. It was a great privilege, especially, to be in the conductor's class because of the fact that they found jobs, and very good ones, for the conductors to be placed in order to start their career. And many of the conductors in this country and all over Europe went through this conducting school, which was also limited to six students.
I see. So who actually, how did you actually get in or get that scholarship to go over there?
My parents paid for me to go, and I studied with a teacher there, and after a year's study I applied to play an examination, and I played the examination and I got accepted.
Oh, I see. So you had to try out.
Oh yes, you try out. Everything is tryout. Every time you took a lesson, it was a tryout.
So that your parents sent you over there for a while and
I was there 5 years, yes.
I see.
I was there 5 years. It was a very difficult 5 years in the sense that the competitive talent and their backgrounds were absolutely superb. I'm not talking about just any two Russians. The two Russians who were in the class with me became the first cellist of the New York Philharmonic and the first cellist of the Pittsburgh Symphony, Joseph Schuster, and I can't remember the other man's name, but he was on this level.
I see.
And Piatigorsky had formerly been a student there. Piatigorsky then became the first cellist of the Berlin Philharmonic and then the outstanding cellist of the world. Clifford Curzon was also another student in the Hochschule, and who studied with Schnabel. He died 2 years ago, and his price per concert when he died was $15,000 a concert. A friend of mine who studied with in the conducting class was an associate of Wilhelm Furtwängler and conducted two symphony orchestras, the Berlin Philharmonic and the Vienna Philharmonic. When Furtwängler conducted one weekend in Berlin, Giovanni di Bella conducted the Vienna Symphony. And then they would switch, and Giovanni would conduct the Berlin Philharmonic, and Furtwängler would conduct the Vienna Symphony Orchestra.
I see. So what year was it when you returned to the United States?
1930.
And so what was your next course of action? What did you do once you returned?
Well, my next course of action was to find out that the sound film had a devastating effect upon employment of musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation in music was really quite chaotic, and after having heard the Berlin Philharmonic and all the marvelous chamber music in Berlin, I found the music in Kansas City was indeed primitive. So I got into the etching business together with a couple of friends, one of whom was studying violin in Paris, and the other of whom had just returned from Paris with whom both Mrs. Stuhl and I played trios.
The etching business? Excuse me. What's the etching business?
The etching business was a very good business to be in, I found out 40, 50 years later, because of the fact that we would buy etching business from, we'd buy etchings from prominent French contemporaries in the years when French Impressionism was still going strong. And we bought prints over there. I have one print which I sold for about $100, which is now worth $40,000. Unfortunately, I sold it. Mm-hmm. But we had several Picassos and very famous prints. But it's very difficult to sell things in those days and very difficult to stay afloat. This was Depression years. Mm-hmm. It was a bad depression.
So tell me why, when you came back from Europe, that you decided not to be associated with the music industry right off hand.
Well, first of all, the kind of music making that went on in Kansas City in comparison to the kind of music making I got thoroughly used to during 5 years of music attendance and participation in Berlin was vastly different. I found that the music making in Kansas City and the teaching as well was indeed in rather a primitive state, and it seemed rather impossible to raise standards to the degree where I would be happy in this profession. So I got into the art business because of two friends of mine. One was at that time a fellow who had just come back from study in Paris, a violinist, with whom Mrs. Stuhl and I played trios, and we traveled extensively. The other one ended up being the concertmaster of the Kansas City Philharmonic, but at that time he was still studying in Paris, and he bought etchings, French contemporary etchings, and sent them over to us, and then we would travel. Mostly I did the traveling all over the United States, going into department stores and art stores with prints. Sometimes I sold them, sometimes I arranged for a small exhibition which they would advertise. I would be there, and we sold a great number of prints. Unfortunately, I was not far-sighted enough to realize that some of these prints someday would be worth thousands and thousands of dollars that I was selling for hundreds of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I had one piece by Chagall. This man, as a matter of fact, died recently. He was a Russian artist. This print is worth today at least $40,000. I sold it for $100.
Oh.
We sold two Picassos for about $100 a piece. These Picassos are probably worth $5,000 to $10,000 a piece, minimum. These were color prints. I also happened to have stored away, mainly because I couldn't sell them at the time, quite a number of prints by a Japanese who lived in Paris and was taken to Paris by his father when he was a year old. His name was Fujita, who is known in Japan as the first and foremost contemporary Japanese artist. And his work was different than anything that that had appeared on the scene, either in French Impressionism or any other form of art, either in Japanese or in Western European art, especially French. So he was a big success.
I see. So how long did you continue selling prints?
Well, I didn't stop exactly, but in the meantime, I found that I would like to start teaching music.
Did that just come to you all of a sudden, or you pretty much felt that you wanted to teach all along?
Well, first of all, I went to see a former friend I had known, whose name was Charles Horner, who later became Assistant Secretary of the War Department. I thought it might be a good idea for me to start teaching because while the standards of cello were so low, they were almost non-existent. There was no cello studied as such compared to today. Mr. Horner said that their cello teacher had left because he had no pupils. Well, I said, it's quite a job, isn't it? But I'll take it. After a year's time, I had 18 students studying regularly, once a week. And this was a result of a pioneering job, which I sincerely believed in. I felt that if they didn't know how to play, that I should use the knowledge I had to teach them. So I went into schools, I went into homes, I went into different towns, so that I did teach at the conservatory. I later resigned the conservatory because it restricted me too much. So I taught in many towns, Kansas City, Fort Scott, Pittsburgh, Chanute, Atchison, Leavenworth, and Iola. This was quite a job. Weekends, my wife would come down and meet us in Fort Scott, where she had a piano class, and where Mark Wood Holmes, this violinist who had just returned from Paris, would also had a class. Now this was a result also of the same pioneering. The class finally grew to the point where I had approximately 85 students. Most of these students were private students. Some of them were class students. At that time, I was allowed to teach during school hours if a student had an easy subject he could get out of once a week or had a study hall. So it made it possible for me to teach more hours per day. I knew many of the superintendents because I'd gone to see them and talked to them about this, and they were heartily in agreement with a broader and better education in music than they were able to supply. Mm-hmm. So this really turned out to be a busy life that I was in, because I traveled approximately 500 miles per week and taught an average class of someplace around 80. After about 3 or 4 years of teaching, I had a student who came in on the railroad, where he had a pass on the railroad. His father was a member of the Board of Regents. He came in every 2 weeks and took 2 lessons on Sunday, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Then he got on the train and went back home. He came in the day before and stayed in one of the downtown hotels and took these lessons and went back home. After he had graduated from high school, he went to KU and studied the cello with Dean Swarthout. Dean Swarthout had studied in Leipzig, Germany, and studied the cello as well as the piano. However, he was really a pianist. This young man studied with Swarthout for 1 year. At the end of that time, he said, "Dean Swarthout, I like studying with you very much, but I like my other teacher better. So I'm going to go back to start and study with him again, if you don't mind." And he said, "What's his name?" He said, "Well, his name is Raymond Stuhl." "Oh," he said, "I've heard many of his students play because I judge many contests in various parts of the state, especially in eastern Kansas." And he said, "I know him very well by his students. I don't know him personally at all. But if you'll send him up to see me, I'll give him a job." This young man relayed the information to Swarthout, and I came to KU, and he did indeed give me a job. I've been there ever since. This was in the year 1935.
So were you overwhelmed to get the job? What were your feelings upon having received that offer?
This was a difficult thing to come into because, again, I came into the same situation as the conservatory. There was one student who had been studying with Dean Swarthout, but his father had been ill, and he was from Salina, so he was not attending school that year. So actually I had one 30-minute lesson a week. After two or three years of teaching in the school, I walked into Swarthout's office and said, "Well, the department's growing. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but we now have 7 cello majors." And he said, "My goodness," he said, "how big do you think that department can be? How large will it get to be?" Well, I said, "I think we can have between 15 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
Whereupon Swarthout, on his swivel chair, rocked back and turned around and laughed for a good minute and a half.
"Just too many or what?"
He said, "It sounds like you're a bit demented." But he said, "Actually, stay with it. You seem to have vision. It may work out," which indeed it did. After my return from the service, I had 18 cello majors and a class of approximately 26 or 20 to 28 students.
I see.
So the class did indeed get greater. The university also grew.
So you concentrated just on the cello, right? You're an instructor just on the cello?
I taught all the sightseeing and ear training for several years because there was no teaching to do. And I also taught chamber music extensively. There was no teaching to do there also either because there were no cellists to play in the ensembles.
Mm-hmm.
But as the cellists began to come in, this gradually became quite a department. Dean Swarthout wanted to develop this department of chamber music because he indeed was interested in it very much.
Can you describe the KU Chamber Music Series a little bit more for me?
Well, the first chamber music that was here was done by Dean Swarthout through the Coolidge Foundation. And the only chamber music of professional status was done during Music Week, which was held every spring as long as he was the dean. And I can remember the Coolidge Quartet coming and play, and some of the London Quartet came and played, but only during this week. The first 5 years I was here, I talked to Dean Swarthout about having a regular chamber music series. He said, "I don't think it can be done. It seems
just like
very unpractical." Well, I said, "Maybe it is, but I don't think so. I think it would work." Well, after seeing him for 5 consecutive years, the 5th time I went to see him, he said, "I finally have a few funds
towards that,
and we will try it. But you'll see there won't be more than 10 people there."
Sure.
I said, "Over my dead body."
Right.
I must say I had some expert assistance. In the help of my wife, Mrs. Bertzel, whose husband was in the German department, and a Mrs. Snyder, Mary Snyder. They knew a great many of the faculty at the university, and they also knew a great number of the people in the town. They worked on the people in the university, the faculty in the university, and the people in the town, and I worked on the students mostly. And I would stop the students in the hall and tell them we were starting this series, and I thought that they should hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the university did not offer any kind of educational opportunity which was of that quality. Mm-hmm. In other words, we had no lecturers who would come to the university and receive an honorarium of, say, from $2,000 to $3,000, as the chamber music groups would receive when they came. The long and short of it was, the students became fascinated with the idea, and we sold the house out, which was Swarthout Hall, which seated about 425 seats. We sold it out in season tickets before the first concert. This was strong in Strong Auditorium, on the third floor of all places.
Hmm.
And to try to find a place to park and to walk up those two flights of stairs took considerable stamina and determination. Nevertheless,
but they got people in there.
The people were there, and they enjoyed the series, and it flourished.
Huh.
It continued to sell out as long as it was located in that.
So what year did that start? Or?
That started probably around maybe 1939.
1939.
That's as close as I could come to it. And Swarthout and I worked at it together until I went into the Army. Then he semi-closed it down, until I got out of the Army again.
So when did you go into the Army?
I went in the Army Air Corps about 1940. That would be my guess. I can't tell you the exact date.
And then you came back and started working again?
Then I started working again. When Swarthout retired, that was a different story, because at that time, Dean Gorton came in, and Dean Gorton wanted to run the series.
I see.
And so he did. I worked out an arrangement with other towns, such as Topeka, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, Manhattan, Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Emporia part of the time. And so they did what we call today block booking. In other words, they bought the same groups. This gave us a special price. But unfortunately, these people didn't really take that much interest, and we ended up having groups which were practically all from back of the Iron Curtain, because they were cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Something I disapproved of heartily. We did have some wonderful groups, however, before Dean Gorton took over and afterwards. Some very important groups indeed, including the Amadeus Quartet. But before that, we brought the Hungarian Quartet, and we also brought the Budapest Quartet, and above all, the Albinary Trio, which to me was the greatest trio that ever existed in the world.
How about the G-U-A-R-N-E-R-I?
Guarneri String Quartet. This took place after,
1977.
Took place in 1977 when Dean Meeser became Dean. I went to a faculty meeting, his first faculty meeting, whereupon he announced that I was going to be in charge of the chamber music series and the concert series without even consulting me. I practically fell out of the chair, but thought it might be smarter if I didn't say anything. So I kept my mouth shut and thought I might be able to do it.
Can you describe the KU concert series a little bit
well,
more?
Well, the KU concert series had been a very famous series, especially under Dean Swarthout. He had brought to this campus every famous soloist of international repute who was in the limelight during the time when he was the dean of the school.
I see.
And one of the examples was a series which he had in 1946-47, called the All-Star Series. And here he had the internationally famous organist Dupre. He had the Metropolitan Opera operatic ensemble consisting of famous singers from the Metropolitan Opera. He had, believe it or not, when Isaac Stern was a very young man, he had Isaac Stern and the famous pianist at the age of approximately 10, whose name was Leon Fleischer. Leon Fleischer had a series of master classes which lasted, I think, 3 years, and at that time he decided he didn't want to do it anymore. He became a very famous pianist, one of the world's most famous, and he also became a very famous teacher, still is a very famous teacher, and he is now also a conductor because he lost the use of his right arm. Mm. It became something strange. He caught a strange disease and said it wouldn't work. And the last on this All-Star series was his niece, Gladys Swarthout, who was a famous Metropolitan soprano. So
the difference, well, I mean, they're both opportunities for famous or, you know, important instrumentalists to come to this college, right?
Yeah. Dean Gorton kept this going and he was much more interested in bringing in orchestras than Dean Swarthout, so we began to hear orchestras. This is a much more difficult thing to achieve because of the fact that there's an enormous expense involved with bringing in fine orchestras. To bring in an orchestra comparable to Isaac Stern, you have to bring in something like the Berlin Philharmonic or the New York Philharmonic, which is prohibitive, even though it is sometimes very highly subsidized. The price of the Berlin Philharmonic today is $50,000. Can you imagine paying $50,000 for one performance? Well, this becomes unpractical. However, we did have the Berlin Philharmonic here under Dean Gorton.
Really?
And Chancellor Murphy was mainly responsible for this concert because of the fact that he thought that it was a very fine thing to do. Shortly after the war was over, he brought the Berlin Philharmonic to this campus, but of course at that time it wasn't as expensive.
That's it. Okay, I'd like to go back a little bit and ask you, what's after the war, did that change your attitude or about wanting to be involved with music or at all? Or did,
as a matter of fact, the war increased my determination to go back to music and see how I could be of further service, not only as a teacher, as an individual teacher or a classroom teacher, but as a bigger influence over in this area of the country. And it was at this time when Dean Mulott was the chancellor, and when Swarthout was still the dean, that Mrs. Stuhl and I decided that we would take on a project of playing in as many schools as would be humanly possible in order to make available a form of education which didn't exist in the public schools. We played for 25 years and played approximately 3,000 concerts in the 6-state area, as well as playing in New York for schools and in the America houses after the war.
So you basically got everything going, it seems like.
I had many people stop me in the hall the following 20 years, and would say, I heard you play in, let's say, Chanute, when I was in junior high. A man called me up and said, I'd like to have my daughter study cello with you, because when I was in junior high in Newton, Kansas, I heard you play, and I've never forgotten the cello, and I'd like to have her learn to play it.
Huh.
This was exactly what I wanted to do, and it amazed both of us that the public, not knowing any much about music and nothing about the cello, would receive it with such enthusiasm. We had the feeling that we were out in order to educate and to enthuse people and to fascinate people with music, but we were actually the people who came back more fascinated and more touched than the people for whom we played.
I can understand, just because you're touching and teaching so many people and getting everything started, it seems.
We worked with the music educators where orchestras existed, and strange to say, there were more orchestras in those days than there are now. All of a sudden, between the years of 1930 and 1950, orchestras mushroomed and were much more prevalent than bands. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the combination of the band and the athletic department became so closely connected that the bands began to exceed in membership.
Mm-hmm.
After that time, then it became much more of a struggle to promote the strings, and has been ever since. But I think they sell it the wrong way.
Today?
I think they sell it the wrong way today because of the fact that this is not sold in such a way that it is part of our educational and cultural program, and it is not part of it should be emphasized that this is a part of Western, European, mm-hmm. and American, our real heritage,
mm-hmm.
and is probably the most unique thing that Western man ever invented,
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that he invented the instruments, he invented the clefs, he invented the notation system, he invented the tonal system, the half tones and the whole tones,
mm-hmm.
and he also produced the genius not only to play these instruments, but certainly to compose for mm-hmm. the instruments, so that what we have today is unbelievably unique, but it's not sold like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's sold as something which is still somewhat precious, somewhat remote, instead of being part of the people's lives. And from the point of view that if you don't know about this, you should know about it, and if you should know about it, here it is, and here is the best, here's a very fine example of what you know little about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I also noticed that in the KU Concert Series, you brought a famous Russian cellist by the name of Rostropovich, yes. He's very famous, isn't he?
He's one of the greatest artists who ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
And when you become such a genius at playing an instrument, the word unbelievable is almost inadequate.
Is he one of the best?
He's one of the finest, not only finest cellists, he's one of the finest artists who ever lived, along with Gregor Piatigorsky, Pablo Casals, Isaac Stern, who's not a cellist, of course, but I would say that he's one of the 10 greatest artists who's lived in the last 150 years.
So what year did he come to the university? Do you remember?
Well, I'll have to do a little calculating here, but it was about 10 years ago, so I would say it was approximately 1975.
I see. So
he was here in the house, and I showed him a picture of I showed him a picture of Red Cloud. We had a big book, and we had a great big picture. I said, I want to show you a picture of an Indian who looked like Beethoven. And he said, don't tell me stories like that. No Indian looked like Beethoven. I got the book out, opened the book, showed it to him. He said, he looks like Peter. And he, Rastafari said, his hair looks like Schumann. He's a very famous composer.
So you mentioned Pablo Casals, right?
Yes.
When you were over in Europe, you studied with him?
No, I didn't study with Casals. Casals came to Berlin and played very often. Casals did not teach at all during those years.
I see.
As a matter of fact, Casals never taught until he came to this country. Not in this, to this country, but to Puerto Rico. And even at that, the teaching was extremely limited. I would say Casals only had one real student, and his name was Casado.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really a Casals student because he had studied with Casals before he became so famous and while he still had time to teach. After that time, he was so busy playing that he had no time to teach. One interesting story about Casals, if we have time to tell it,
sure,
would be that Casals went to Russia on a tour, and this was told to me by one of Russia's most famous cellists and absolutely one of the members of this trio I mentioned, which was called the Albinari Trio. This man's name was Benner Heifetz, then a cousin of Yasha Heifetz, the violinist. When Casals came to give the first concert, everyone went to hear a man come and play as he did, because the objective of the most of the Russian cellists, and indeed many, many of the violinists, was to play with a great, big, luscious, beautiful tone. And Casals came and played with a very beautiful tone, but he played loud and soft and varied the quality of the tone.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians had never even thought of playing like that.
Mm.
And they were absolutely fascinated. And so he was a great influence there, and went back to Russia many times after that to concertize until the communist system became impossible. Well, one of my students, John Ehrlich, who got a master's degree here and went to Europe on a Fulbright. After he accepted a job on the faculty as a professor at Drake University in Des Moines, he started studying with Casals for 2 years in Prague. He commuted between Paris, where he lived, and Prague. Went there every 2 weeks, and then had two-hour lessons. Came back and practiced all day long, and went back and took another lesson from Casals. He's the only student that I had who studied with. That's the only student I ever had who studied with him. But it was a rare privilege because very few people have had the chance of doing it.
I see. Can you tell me a little bit about Alan Harris? I have a little information about him.
Well, Alan Harris was indeed a very talented young man. Yes, he studied with me in high school. This is rather an interesting story because another student of mine was the head of the music in the public school. His name was Jack Stevenson, who is now the head of the music education department at UMKC. I came to Jack after I got out of the army and saw that there were no cellists in the school, so I said, I will accept 4 talented young men and teach them for nothing. All the time they're in high school, junior high and high school, if they want to make music a career,
mm-hmm,
and come into KU later. Whereupon Jack found 4 very gifted young men,
mm-hmm,
one of whom was Alan Harris, who graduated from here. He studied with me about 10 years. Later became the a member of the faculty of the Eastman School, then after that, a member of the Cleveland Institute, and is now the head of the cello department and a full professor at Northwestern University. And also a member of the faculty at the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado. Another one of those four boys is the music supervisor, head of all instrumental and vocal music in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this young man was not indeed at half as talented as Alan Harris, but became probably the greatest influence on young people of any person I know, because he developed a string program in Albuquerque consisting of 2,800 people studying string instruments in a town of, say, not over a half a million people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's larger, I can't tell you the population of Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
He has three youth orchestras, any one of which is better than any youth orchestra in the state of Kansas by far. He took them to Europe twice. He has been instrumental in helping other people get string programs started, but he has that peculiar kernel of genius for getting people, for developing a certain fascination for playing stringed instruments. And he's been very practical in the way he has gone about hiring, engaging people to become members of his music department. But it is the biggest string program per capita of any place on the face of the earth.
Hmm.
The other boy is not far away in Los Alamos, New Mexico, where they have a wonderful orchestra. As you know, Los Alamos is a nuclear center,
mm-hmm.
and they're practically all the people who live there are physicists or scientists, and he has all of these people. The average IQ in the high school there, even including the natives, some of whom have only an IQ of maybe 70 or 80, but still their IQ average of IQ is 152. I can't remember what happened to the fourth one, but I'll think of it before I'm through.
So these were probably the most outstanding students that you've taught?
No, I wouldn't say altogether. I've had many other outstanding students. I had a girl who started studying at the age of 8, whose name was Sebi Jean Sarcer. She left this area when I went into the Army, went to New York City and studied with a famous Russian cellist, and later became a member of the opera, the City Center Opera Company. Played in two or three other symphony orchestras and ended up in Kansas City as the assistant first cellist of the Kansas City Philharmonic. Another student, when she quit that job, another student came up from Albuquerque, New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
who had actually been a business major, but he was a very fine cellist. He never stopped practicing the cello. His name was Arthur Fielder. He was not a graduate of the KU Music School, but he was a fine cellist, and he became the assistant first cellist of the Kansas City Philharmonic. There are other very fine cellist. Hold on. In talking of my students, I'd like to start out with a story that I heard just the other night from a member of the Beaux-Arts Trio, the most famous trio in the world today. And his name is
Bernard
Greenhouse. Bernard Greenhouse said that I had sent him more fine students for graduate study and postgraduate for doctoral study than anyone in the United States.
Huh.
There are other teachers who have received fine students. Harris went to a man named Starker. I sent Starker quite a number of students. There have been others as well. I'll talk about some of the outstanding students. I had a student whose name was Lyle Wolfram, who's now teaching in a state college in Kentucky. Rita Gonzalez Thompson, who after graduating taught in the Fort Scott schools for a while, abandoned music as a profession, but her daughter is a member of the San Antonio Symphony, and her daughter studied at KU, studied music, studied cello with me at KU. I haven't said anything in detail about Jack Stevenson, who got a doctor's degree in music education at my suggestion. Jack was a talented cellist, but I felt that he had more of a disposition to teach and to work in the field of education than work as a professional cellist. So he did get a degree in cello, but he got a doctor's degree in music education. He taught music education at the University of New Mexico and then moved to the University of Missouri at Kansas City. He taught here at Lawrence High School, yes, before he, that was his first position. Stephen Shumway, outstanding cellist, who just played a concert here the other night. He's one of the ones I also sent to Greenhouse. He teaches in a college in Ohio and has become a very fine cellist. He still has most of his life yet to live. He's not yet 30. He's trying out for in a contest called the Naumburg, which is the most difficult contest in the world probably to win. But he's going to try out and see how he comes out. If he doesn't win, he'll come close to it. Don Watts is teaching in a college back in Baltimore, Maryland. Linda Judd went to the University of Texas. The man down there is a pupil of Piatigorsky, a very fine cellist who was formerly the first cellist of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And he also says that the finest prepared students he's ever had came out of the undergraduate program at KU. She won a contest at Oklahoma City called the I can't recall the name, but at any rate, it entitled her to receive an honorarium of $500 and also to be placed on the same series as with playing solos with the Oklahoma City Symphony as Isaac Stern was and internationally famous people. And she played very well and played very satisfactorily. Extremely talented girl. She is teaching, she taught in Wisconsin in a state school and has moved, and I have lost track of her. Someone has said that she's now playing in South America. Merle Clayton is the assistant first cellist to the Dallas Orchestra. And he's also the man who represents the musicians union with the administration. So he's actually the go-between between the orchestra personnel and the administrative and the board, administration and the board. That places him in the correct position because he'd had two or three years in the business school. After he got out of the Army, he decided he was going to start out in music. He liked that better than business, so he got a degree in cello here, went further to, again, this man in Texas. Sue Gewinner was a girl who was extremely talented. She's a member of the Oakland Symphony in Oakland, California. Damian Soko went to a position in San Antonio, Texas, in the San Antonio Symphony. Later, is a teacher in the one of the schools in New York City, perhaps one of the settlement schools, I'm not sure, but this is not to be confused with some just little fly-by-night schools, a very serious music school. Mm-hmm. Jolene Kessler studied with me for about 6 or 7 years. She continued her study at Wichita because her family moved there, and this was not exactly an economic problem, but they wanted her down there. And I think for rather a good reason at the time, because she was not as stable as she finally has turned out to be. She married another student of mine, Kevin Crutter. They live in Boston today, and they simply make a living by playing jobs. Any kind of a job that comes in, up, they play it. Mm. And, they also teach. They have extensive classes. Outstanding student was another outstanding student with Kathy Wolfe, whose father inherited a department store in Detroit, and she worked for her father. What her musical activities are today, I'm at a loss to say. Mm-hmm. Another one whose name is Evan Tonzing, who teaches Stillwater, Oklahoma. He has the cello department, and also he's head of the theory department. One of the finest students I ever had was a young man named Carl Piper, who has a standing offer to play with the St. Louis Symphony anytime he wants to. This is a very difficult orchestra to get into, but he went to St. Louis in order to pursue a study of electronics with emphasis on its medical importance, such as the development of various mechanical devices used in hospitals. He ended up with a doctor's degree in neurobiology and a doctor's degree in computer science. No, a master's degree in computer science and a doctor's degree in electrical engineering. Shirley Foster is a girl who graduated from here and pursued her study in New York City and was a very fine student, is now teaching in the southeastern Kansas as a private teacher. I believe that, there are a couple of other names here which should be mentioned. Walter Hawkey teaches at the University of Arkansas, where part of his teaching is devoted to teaching cello and strings in the university, and part of it is to supervise the string study in the Little Rock, Arkansas public schools. Verna Jarnett is a very fine teacher, and she teaches in Tucson, Arizona. And August Zilborg, a most wonderful talent, who was here for only a couple of years because she didn't want to come here in the first place. She wanted to come go to a big city, but she did stay here and for 2 years, then went also to Greenhouse. So Greenhouse has good reason to say that talented people have come to him via my studio.
Uh-huh.
So Richard Magg is a teacher at Furman University in South Carolina. Donna Moore teaches cello at Corvallis, Oregon. That's a state institution where another student, violin student, teaches, whose name is Marlon Carlson. I believe we've gone as far as I need to go, but I have a list, as you can see from this page, which will take up another 5 minutes, but I think that these names won't mean very much to most people.
Yeah.
That includes Marianne Dresser. Mm-hmm. Two other students I neglected to mention are Robert Stewart, who has been at Missouri State College in Warrensburg, Missouri, and has been a big influence there. And the other one is Marianne Dresser, who recently received her doctoral degree from the University of Texas and is a member of the Austin Symphony and is a private teacher there. Very talented, intelligent girl. All of these people play in their communities and add greatly to it. There's one girl whose name is Jane Shackelford, who never played a note or gave a single lesson, but she did teach music in the schools. I had about 200 hours on her transcript. and is a tremendous influence in New York State in the areas of creating interest in attending concerts, not only in her own community, but all over the area where she lives. And it's a great contribution. Another one is William Ward, who's the Associate Dean of the School of Liberal and Fine Arts at San Francisco State University, with a student population in this one particular department or school of 14,000 students. And he's also quite a composer. He also studied cello and was in a cello choir, which I have in the other room, in the picture. And it's very interesting to look at these. Bill Wagner graduated from KU and studied all the time he was here, and he's a surgeon today. I think that's probably enough.
Okay, you've accomplished quite a bit, I can see. Are there any other honors which you've received?
Well, I received quite a few honors. I'm not sure I can remember all of them, but I was cited three times as a Hilltop Professor. I'm not sure that still exists.
And also, can you describe the Hilltop Professor a little bit?
In the Hill Teacher, it was formerly called the Hilltop Professor.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's been changed to Hill Teacher. Also, I received the award of the Distinguished Professor Award 1 year. As a matter of fact, that was the year I retired.
Chancellor's.
It's the Chancellor's Award.
I see.
I received two awards from the American String Teachers Association for outstanding teachers, outstanding teaching, and this was a national association, and also two awards from the Kansas State Teachers Association, String Teachers Association, for outstanding teachers and contribution to music through playing for so many young people.
Any other honors that you'd like to mention?
Well, I was selected during a meeting of the American String Teachers Association, a national meeting, to make a speech to Cazals, who was unable to attend the meeting because of the weather and because of the fact that he was threatened with pneumonia at the time. He had such a bad cold. So I was selected to speak to him after he played a couple of pieces over the radio, or over the telephone, which we all heard. There were about 800 of us there, I think. And I gave the speech of acceptance at that time, and also talked about my experiences in Europe, and gave also comments about teaching. One of the comments dealt with Benner Heifetz, who had told me this story about Pavel Cazals in Russia, among many other things. I had a cello choir which played, the choir played many, many places, and they had a cello choir at that time down there, in which we had, I think, 8 students participate. It was a rather large cello choir of some 60 people from all over the United States. So we felt lucky to have met that many people.
Can you describe to me a little bit more about what the cello choir was?
Well, the cello choir is a group of cellists, and the cello is a singular instrument insofar as it has the greatest range of any instrument in the orchestra, so composers can write for this group and have it almost as interesting, it's a bit more restricted to be sure, as an entire string section of an orchestra, because they can play so high and they can play so low. And the literature, while limited, does exist, and many of the works which have been written for this choir are really thrilling to hear. It's a different kind of a sound. And the people who hear that, hear the cello choir, if it plays well, are really fascinated with it, to the degree that the Berlin Philharmonic has sold quite a few records of their cello choir, which they have called the Cellists of the Berlin Philharmonic. I think there's something like 12 or 18 in this group. The records are fascinating.
So overall, what aspect of your profession did you feel you valued the most?
Well, I think the word can be just, I can say that in one word, service. Service to the community, service to the university, service to young people, service to education, service to enlightenment, and certainly service to the culture of Western civilization.
Okay, can you, what were some of the major changes that you saw in your department over your career that you'd like to discuss?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd rather not hold it down to the department, but to talk about major changes, period.
Sure, that's fine.
Major changes have been enormous. As you well know, when I first came to the university, it was a school of someplace between 3,000 and 4,000 people. Now that it's 24,000, tells somewhat of a story without any elaboration.
Mm-hmm.
However, we have lost a great deal of ground, and I don't like to sound pessimistic, because this is exactly the situation that I have been trying to combat all of my life. When I first came here, this small school would have concerts and Hope Auditorium would be full.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it takes an enormous celebrity to even begin to fill it, mm-hmm. or a great orchestra. It's true, they will fill it, but only with the most difficult efforts, which was not really necessary. This is due, of course, to many things. Mainly, we have much more competition in television and in radio and other forms of entertainment. There are many other things to do,
mm-hmm.
not good things to do, in my opinion, but they are activities. Many of them are good. I don't mean to say that they're many bad, but they are
just draw people.
They draw people away, so that they actually keep people much more busy. People are busier than
mm-hmm.
they ever have been. Students are busier. They have less free time to dream, less dream time, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the per capita attendance to concerts is, the nation over, but particularly in the Midwest, is alarming, because with 24,000 students, in comparison to 4,000 students, is a tremendous contrast, and yet we have difficulty in filling the same hall that we were able to fill when we only had 4,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that the things that people do instead of going to a concert aren't just as valuable, but I would say that many of them are much less valuable, and many of them are really bad influences.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point is that we have not been at all efficient in letting people know about the importance of music and what a great part of it, of our own lives, it should be and could be. And really, in a sense, is, in that we did invent it, and we developed it. So that the field of concertizing and the field of being a professional concert artist today is an overcrowded field, not because there's too many players, it's because the audience is getting smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So that this change is one which should be dealt with directly and much more efficiently than it's being handled.
How do you feel you go about that?
Well, that I think I can write a book about.
Yeah,
I just
know.
May.
We might have to. Maybe that will change everything.
Yeah. audiences over the entire Western world, but especially in the United States, have been influenced by a low-class type of entertainment over television and radio, which we may never get over unless people take certain steps. And these steps are simple and practical and possible as long as we can find people who have the ability to talk well and to play well and work very, very hard.
Need people like you to go around again and
people
promote
need to
it.
Go into every avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it would be very appropriate if in the school system they not only had concerts where people could talk and explain the music, but play one instrument at a time, give a short concert, talk about the instrument, and if necessary, go into the individual classrooms and talk about it, so that the people would get much closer to the conductor, to the player, and much closer to the instrument, and have a much warmer and more personal feeling about what was being done. They would go to concerts. When I first started this last stint that I did with the Chamber Music and Concert Series, I vowed and declared that I would have many concerts on Sunday afternoon, because I discovered at that time that there was nothing for the students to do on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
except trivial things, very trivial things. Either that or study.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it was a good time to have these concerts because of the fact that they had the entire weekend to get their lessons for Monday, and if they were not done by the time they got out of the concert hall in Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening, they still had the entire evening for further study before the Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So this seemed to me to be also a very good idea because of the fact that people who were unable to go out at night could come and enjoy this music.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we get back to this matter of accessibility, and at the same time, exposure. And if we could expose the idea of going to concerts to more people by giving them a sample, and it's just as practical as the people who come around and used to give us samples of Kellogg's cornflakes in little boxes, and they would say, try this, and if you like it, of course you can buy it at your grocery. And this worked very well and was done for years and years and years, for 40 years at least. A sample of something which is of excellent quality almost always catches on. Not to 100% of the people, of
mm-hmm.
course, but nothing does.
Mm-hmm.
So by and large, I think this is the kernel that it takes. But it takes a very knowledgeable, persistent, fascinated person with that kind of subject
mm-hmm.
before you can do it.
So what year did you retire from KU, from the staff?
77. Let me see, this is 1977, right.
But you still remain real active in teaching cello? And
I'm very active. As a matter of fact, I was just called by a student who's going to try out for a contest in Topeka. This call was from Topeka, and he wants to try out the hall.
I see. Do most of your students come to you now?
Yes, I have many students. Now, I do go. I'm an adjunct professor at Washburn University, where I teach about
One day.
6 hours, a day a week.
I see.
And this is a high school student who is trying out in this contest. I have three high school students who are trying out. A girl from Olathe who comes here for lessons,
mm-hmm.
and a girl who studies with me in Topeka, and a boy who comes on Saturday from Topeka and studies. That's it, isn't it? Yeah.
Well,
three students. But I have had five students out of five entries in this contest, four of them have won have won the division, not the cello division, but the string division. That's the violin, viola, cello, or bass. And that's in about the last five or six years. So they've enjoyed, it's been a great experience for them, and they've done very well with it.
All right. What, if any, contacts do you still have with the university?
When I left the university, my connection with the music school as a teacher and connection with the concert series, which I continued to work at for a couple more years, were so closely tied that I felt that it was a much better idea that I make myself scarce for a few years in order to give the new people who came in a completely free rein on doing what they thought they'd like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we all feel, I think, when we assume this kind of responsibility, and especially if we've been around for a while, we feel that we would like not to be tied down by too much advice from the other person. So I had not been very active with the university since. I think it's not a bad policy, and I noticed that many of my friends, both at KU and other places in the country, have taken very much the same attitude.
Mm.
Now it's a different matter. If I begin to be more active in this kind of thing, it will be mostly because I have a little bit more time.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very busy.
Mm-hmm.
I've been more busy since I retired than before, because of the fact that my teaching schedule all of a sudden was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but it was. I had a bigger...
Well, because of that reason, I felt you had a little more time, so everybody's coming to you.
So, I don't know, but the students literally came out of the walls.
Hmm.
Same time I started going to Topeka, they called me from Topeka and asked me if I'd do that, and I said, yes, I think I'll have some time. I'm not knowing that I was going to be that busy. Otherwise, I would never have allowed myself to get into it, but you can't anticipate that. So life has been very busy and really extreme and quite fascinating. I'm influential in the chamber music series in Topeka because mainly they would have lost it unless somebody with a little bit more professional savvy than anyone over there on that board had to make it flourish. Now it's doing much better again. We have a good turnout for the concerts we have over there, which are five in number, and they're in an excellent hall, good location. I don't like the time of the week, but it's always been on Saturday night, and it's not a bad time at all. Last summer I was called by a former student and asked if I'd come to San Antonio to conduct a cello choir consisting of 55 people. They had been rehearsing this, and hopefully it was going to be a big success, but they couldn't seem to bring it off. This was the University of Texas at San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me to come down, arrange for transportation, nice place to stay, and I had about three rehearsals, which is extremely limiting, but in those three rehearsals, we got a great deal done. The concert was a big success. It was a sellout, and it was really a fascinating thing to do insofar as it was a combination of the string section of the San Antonio, cello section of the San Antonio Symphony, mixed with high school, junior high school, and grade school students. And I've never tried to put this kind of combination together, but it finally worked out very well when I began to ask these little youngsters if they could hear anybody else except themselves, and if they knew what they should listen for except what their own part.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't know their own part that well, they'd better go home and learn it, because we could never have a concert if they could just play their own part and not pay any attention to what else went on.
Okay, what are your hopes or changes that you feel will occur in the future for KU or the music department?
This is a very thought-provoking question that no one can answer, but I can tell you how I feel about it. There must be greater emphasis on not only playing, but also music listening, in order to make our future, musical future in America secure. I think it's in great jeopardy at the time, because this is a great day of change, and it can be a very great day of change for the better or a great day of change for the worse, depending upon who puts how much energy into what. I'm not talking about just KU now, I'm talking about the whole Western world. KU has always been a great school, it's still a great school. The problems of the administration, the problems of the faculty are far more complex than they were when I taught there. They continue to be more complex because the social problems are more difficult. I find that young people are smarter now than they were. They know a great deal more in many respects, but in other respects they know a great deal less. It's hard to sum it up. Again, the society is so complex that it's a very difficult thing to do. If I were asked how I can improve the University of Kansas, it would be impossible for me to give a direct answer. I'm sure that most anyone would be glad to listen to a direct answer, which if it were right. But it's like asking, how are you going to make the world safe from a vicious war in the future? No one can give you that answer. The most that we can hope for is that we have more pioneers for the positive, not only in music, but in the student life in general, and more cultivation and more encouragement for good habits and good activities, good healthy activities, which are not time wasters, but which are thought-provoking and fascinating. Not easy. It says, a friend of mine who was a great chamber music player said, the highest form of music known is chamber music, and it's the lousiest form of entertainment.
Okay, well, I think that pretty much covers everything I wanted to ask you. There is a couple things I would like to go back. I never asked when you all were married. I forgot to incorporate that with your whole history.
We've been married about 53 years.
No, yeah. I can't turn it off. Did you get married before you went to Europe, or?
Oh no, I got married
after.
Just after I came to KU.
I see. Okay, and then I also forgot to ask you about your experiences in the Kansas City Philharmonic. Did you actually play in the Kansas City?
I played with the Kansas City Philharmonic for 3 years. When I first started playing in the Kansas City Philharmonic was when it was first started.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around, and the people who had been making a living by playing looked so poverty-stricken and sour and discouraged and disgruntled I thought that this was no life to lead.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dean Swarthout offered me this position, I accepted it. But of course, I was not actually primarily a symphony player. I was primarily a teacher, because I lost many students by playing these 3 years with the Kansas City Philharmonic, because I didn't have time to teach 80 students a week and make the rehearsals and play the concerts.
Yeah.
And also be prepared for the concerts. So something had to give, and coming to KU certainly was the ideal out for, in many respects. I had also at that time quite a number of advanced high school players, and these high school players migrated to KU. Dean Swarthout later said, I had really very little choice. when I hired you, because you're the only person who had any students. And if we were ever going to have any cellists in the University of Kansas, they had to find some place to get them, and you had them all. So you're here for a number of reasons, and your standards are very high. You've shown that you're a success, and you're young, so this was the obvious move to make.
I see. All right, I think that covers about it. Everything I need. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention?
Well, one thing, you've conducted this very well, and I'd like to congratulate you. The light touch that you have, and the questions you've asked, and the way you've been prepared.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed talking with you very much.
Thank you. I've just finished my interview with Mr. Stuhl at his home, located at 1515 University Drive. Mr. Stuhl is very kind and helped me out a lot in this interview. We were in his living room, I guess you'd call it, and right off the entranceway into the house. It was a very comfortable setting. We were next to the fireplace. Very comfortable, very relaxed atmosphere. The only distractions that I would say were mainly his wife was sitting in with him, and so he'd be distracted, as you could probably tell from the tape, and she would like whisper things to him and try to enhance his past a little bit so that he could talk to me. And I think that was kind of a distraction, because she kept making me turn off the tape every time that she wanted to say something, so it kind of distracted the overall interview and his train of thoughts at times. But more or less, he was very, very good at answering my questions and put a lot of thought into it. The only other distractions basically were one phone call during the interview, but this came at a pretty opportune time because we weren't discussing anything at the moment. This was one of his students calling. So more or less the interview was very well done, I believe. Maybe you won't, but he did answer all the questions that I had down, and was not at all as inhibitive as I thought he was going to be before the interview. And as you said, he did let me take the tape once I sat down and talked to him. I think before he was hesitant about the interview just because he thought he was going to be busy, but it turned up it was snowing today, so we had time to talk. Everything went pretty well.